The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Tan Chung Han. Now, the Asia School of Business is a partnership between Bank Negara Malaysia and MIT Sloan. Now, even with those stellar names behind this MBA program, will that be enough to give ASB graduates an edge given the abundance of MBAs in the world today? This morning on The Breakfast Grill, we have Professor Charles Fine, Dean of the Asia School of Business. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, folks, if you have any questions for the good professor about ASB and the merits of its MBA program, feel free to WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Again, that's 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, Professor, let's begin with the genesis of the Asia School of Business. How did this come about?
Well, quite a few years ago, Tan Sri Dr. Zeddy, who was governor of the Bank Negara Malaysia, started several different schools in Malaysia. So over her 16-year term as governor, she started the ECLIF School, which is the School of Leadership. She started INCF, which is the School of Islamic Finance. And she was involved in MISI, which is the School of Supply Chain Management. So her view, as I understand it, was that the role of a central bank is not only in a developing economy, an emerging economy, is not only to support the financial environment, but also to support economic development. And in her view, building world-class educational institutions is part of supporting economic development in an emerging economy like Malaysia's. Hmm.
So ASB is Zeti's baby, pretty much.
It was her brainchild, if you will, her vision, right. And she initiated the conversations with MIT.
Got it. Now, given that there are thousands of MBA programs across Asia, question here is, do we really need another one?
So I think that's a very good question. If you look at the rankings of the top 100 business schools in the world, the vast majority are in the West, not in Asia. But if you look at the number of people needing management education over the next decades and the next century, there are probably more in Asia than anywhere else. Asia is the growth economy engine of the world today. It's the growth opportunity engine, 4 billion people, and not many top business schools in this region. So we think there's a huge opportunity for a new business school in this region if we manage to become a premier school, and that's our objective.
Well, that's the thing. You already have some of these premier schools in Singapore, in China, certainly. So how are you going to compete with these stellar names, you know, while trying to be different from them?
So we have quite a unique offering. If you look at the history of business schools over the last 100 years, 100 years ago, business school curriculum was basically retired business executives telling their war stories to young people. All right, so it was a war story-based curriculum. That evolved into a case study-based curriculum. So let's formalize the war stories into case studies. We'll tell you all the case studies. You'll learn the case studies. Then the next phase in the 50s and 60s was mathematical models of management. Can we be analytical and systematic about how we analyze business problems? And I would say the most recent trend is to add what we call action learning or clinical-based learning. So students spend part of their time in the classroom, but part of their time working on projects in organizations and applying in real time what they're learning in the business schools. Our advantage, so many of the top business schools in the world today are investing in this clinical-based or action-based learning, but they're doing it with legacy systems and legacy business school designs, and they're trying to add incrementally action learning curricula components. We had the luxury of designing our business school curriculum from scratch, clean sheet of paper, and we've integrated action learning or clinical learning, experiential learning into every aspect of our program. That gives us a very unique offering, not only in Asia, but in the world.
I mean, you mentioned this action learning component, obviously a key feature of your program there. Yet, when I did my research, this action learning concept was actually developed by MIT back in the 1980s. Really, is it still as relevant now in 2017 and beyond?
Well, actually, if you go back to the founding of MIT in 1861...
You had action learning already back then?
Action learning was part of the the concept of MIT. The motto of MIT on the MIT seal is mens et manus, mind and hand, which says learning is not just does not just happen in your head. It happens in with your learning in your mind and then your action in your hands. That you don't do you really know something unless you can put it into action, if you will.
Yeah. So given these case studies, these mathematical models, this action learning again, and then you juxtapose that with the tremendous disruption that we're seeing in the business space. Really, how relevant will your MBA program be? I mean, how do you preempt something that you don't know?
So our students, over the course of their two-year program, 20-month program, will work on five different projects in five different companies in five different countries in the region. In addition, they'll spend time in the United States at MIT. We think that gives them a significant edge. That is, management today, to a significant degree, is global management, is international management. There's no domestic management anymore. Every business is global. Every competitive situation is global. Our students will have a very broad and deep exposure to a broad range of business cultures and business environments. And anytime you have to go into a new environment, you have to learn how to do that. Our students will have had five shots at doing that already. Mm. We think that's going to give them advantage, and we can already see that in our students who have been with us for a year, that they have a greater confidence and capability to go into an organization and a culture they've never been involved with before and know how to get started, know how to make an impact.
Mm. Now, I hear you say that on one hand, you want to develop these globalized graduates, right? Yet, from my research, I gather that your graduates tend to be tailored to the Malaysian market. Is that a fair assessment? Are you tailoring your ASB graduates for the Malaysian market?
So out of our 82 students, about a quarter of them are Malaysian. Three quarters are from other parts of the world, including North America, South America, Africa, Australia, Europe, etc. So our students are from all over the world. They do one of their action learning projects in Malaysia, but we've also had projects in Vietnam, in Philippines, in Thailand, in Singapore, in Hong Kong, in U.S., I think we've had 25 different countries where we've had our students do projects. So we're not tailoring for the Malaysian market particularly. We're tailoring for the international market, although our students are certainly absorbing a lot of Malaysian culture by virtue of the fact that we're based here.
Mm. Now, when you consider, say, the Western business culture, if there's such a thing, versus, say, Eastern business culture, what are some major key differences that you can point out for us?
So I think in Asia, people communicate challenging issues differently in many cases. So in some Western cultures, the accepted way to deal with conflict is straight on, is to in some sense be aggressive and frank. In Asia, people are more subtle in the way they communicate challenges, conflict. And you have to find other ways to communicate with people and interact with people. And oftentimes the Western approach doesn't go over very well in the Asian environment, where if you come off as too brash and too abrupt and too forthcoming, if you will, that's not necessarily well accepted. On the other hand, the Asian approach of subtlety and perhaps a less direct verbal interaction, sometimes that's not well accepted in the West. And so we have to build a student capability so they adjust how they interact in an environment to the appropriate cultural norms and the appropriate cultural environment. That's hard to learn, and you don't learn it by sitting in a classroom. You learn it by working on projects in a broad range of organizations.
All right. Now, there's also been plenty of doubt being cast on the value of an MBA to begin with. You know, just a quick Google search, you've got articles from Forbes Asia back in 2015 with a headline, and I quote, "MBAs are part of the problem, not the solution." Last year, in The Economist, quote, "Nothing special, MBAs are no longer prized by employers." How do you counter those kind of headlines?
So, as you said, there are over 10,000 MBA programs just in Asia. There may be 20,000 in the world. If you look at the demand for the students in the top schools, it's quite high. The salaries that come out of MIT, Harvard, Stanford, Wharton are impressive, are high and dramatic. and businesses covet high capability MBAs. On the other hand, there are schools where the MBA graduates don't find jobs or don't find better jobs than they would have before the program because the perception is that they didn't, the program was not, didn't add enough value. So we have to aspire to, and what we aim to do is be at the top tier. We want to compete with the best schools in the world. We want to deliver value, deliver graduates who can deliver value. So if you have a student who worked on a project in a company and that project in a 3-month project saved $1 million, then that student can say, I know how to create value, and a company's going to pay a salary for that capability if I can save you $1 million a year. On the other hand, if you only learned how to read cases and write answers to cases, maybe nobody's willing to pay for that.
All right. And you mentioned a very key word there, salaries. And we'll take a closer look into that, perhaps some of the ROIs and other numbers associated with your MBA program. In just a few minutes, we'll be discussing that. I'm speaking to Professor Charles Fine, the Dean of the Asia School of Business.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Thanks for staying with us. I'm Tan Chung Han, and with me in the studio is Professor Charles Fine, Dean of the Asia School of Business, which is a collaboration between Malaysia Central Bank and MIT Sloan. Now, Professor, this notion that an MBA will allow someone to greatly improve their earning potential, does that notion still apply in today's context? I mean, again, given the abundance of MBAs out there.
Absolutely. So we've been told by many companies that we've talked with in the region that their growth is not constrained by the market opportunities. They say the market opportunities in Asia are tremendous. The growth opportunities are tremendous. They say what we're constrained by is talent. If we had more talent, more capable talent, stronger people, we could grow faster. That's our objective, to train market-ready talent to enter this Asian market and to contribute value into the economy.
So that suggests that the Asian context is different from what we're seeing, say, in the States, because apparently some 200,000 students from American institutions alone are awarded MBAs every single year. And you're almost seeing that spillover even into your program. I think about a fifth of your class of 2018 are Americans as well. So you're saying that the growth trends, at least when it comes to salaries here in Asia, very different from what you see back home.
So I would say there are high salaries in Asia and there are high salaries in North America, and there are low salaries in both places. And there are students who graduate in very high demand where they get many job offers, and the students who graduate with no job offers. There's just a huge amount of variation. An MBA is not an MBA. It's sort of like saying every high school graduate is the same. They're not. Every MBA graduate is not the same. So we aim to admit students at the high end of the capability spectrum. We aim to deliver educational value at the high end of the spectrum. And we aim to graduate students who will be at the high end of the capability spectrum. Now, that's our promise. That's our objective. We've got to prove it, and that's what we're working on.
Exactly. So, again, potential versus reality, right? Let me throw some numbers at you. Some more numbers.
Sure.
You're from MIT, you know. Yeah,
numbers, I like numbers. Yeah,
yeah, definitely. So, look, according to The Economist, 20% of business school graduates say that their MBAs did not improve their earnings power. That's 1 in 5, right? Then according to, again, The Economist, the 79% of MBA graduates who really did increase their salary only applied for those who graduated from elite B schools. I mean, let's face it, ASB, you guys are the new kids on the block. You're not on the elite spectrum right now. So what do you tell your students then, you know, in terms of their ROI?
What we tell our students is that we're going to deliver to them an elite education. Most of our courses are taught by MIT professors, either professors who fly over to Malaysia to teach the courses or when we bring our students to MIT. So we tell them we're going to give them an elite education. And we've also invested in building relationships with elite corporations who are interested in hiring our students. So our students work on these action learning projects with the companies that we've engaged as partners, and these companies include leading regional, national, and global companies who operate in Asia. Right. So we think we have a solid strategy for how to develop elite graduates from an elite school, but we have to prove ourselves, no question about that. We, as you say, we're the new kid on the block. We're aiming high. We're working hard. We've got the resources we need from MIT and Bank Negara, and we have to pull it together.
Elite education apparently comes via elite pricing as well. Let's talk fees now. Look, your fees for international students, though, oh my word, 365,000 ringgit, approximately 85 grand, that's US dollars, and that's for your 20-month program. Now, I compare that with, say, INSEAD, like the world's top MBA program. They are just $10,000 more. All right. And on top of that, their students also save a year. They are a one-year program. You are 20 months. So how do you justify that, if I may call it, elite price point?
So we actually benchmarked against INSEAD in Singapore and Hong Kong University as two of the top MBA programs in English-speaking Asia, at least. And both of them have a total cost of about $100,000 US. We targeted at that. To go to MIT or Harvard or Stanford today costs about 75% more than that, about $175,000 US to go to one of their programs. So we're priced aggressively for the Asian market. We're priced competitively for the elite Asian market, but we're priced low compared to the elite U.S. market. Now, is that a reasonable price point? We think we'll have to prove that. That is, our students – right now we're giving a lot of scholarships to students. Students take a risk coming to a new school, so we have a lot of scholarships available. Our hope and intent is that our students, when our first student batch graduates next spring, they will get salaries that in some sense will justify the tuition, that we can say to future students, look, this is the kind of salary you can earn when you graduate, so you can afford to take a loan to pay this tuition rate. If we can't deliver – jobs like that, we obviously can't charge that tuition rate. So again, we have to prove ourselves. We're a young school, and ask me again in a year, and I'll have more data for you.
All right, we're going to hold you to that, right? All right. A year from now, come back on the breakfast.
I'm happy to come back.
Now, at the same time, though, that 85 grand, that's still about 15 grand more expensive than what you got back home at MIT Sloan back in Boston, right? So again,
our tuition is 85,000 US for the 2 years. At Sloan, it's about 175,000 full cost for 2 years.
Okay.
So we're less than Sloan. We're less than the top US schools by a significant portion.
I've got numbers here on the Nikkei saying 71 grand.
Per year for times two.
Got it. Okay.
And that's plus living costs.
Yeah, maybe I need an education and research as well. We got to talk about rankings right now. In this part of the world, we are obsessed with rankings. So again, how are you going to put ASB on the map against the B schools in Singapore, China, etc.?
Yeah. So we are currently in the process of accreditation through the Ministry of Higher Education, through the MQA process. Once we have that accreditation and once we've been operating for 2 years, we can apply for accreditation to the AACSB, which is the largest accreditation certification body. Once we're accredited, we can then apply to be in the ranking system. And the ranking systems have multiple things that they look at. They look at the quality of the faculty, the quality of the students, the quality of the jobs, the response of the recruiters, et cetera, et cetera. So we're working all those pieces to try to be excellent on all those dimensions so that when we're eligible to be ranked within a couple of years, we hope to come out well. As you know, in the QS ranking, MIT's been ranked the number one university for the last 5 or 6 years. So we've got a great heritage, and we've got to build on that heritage and show that the ASB is worthy of the MIT relationship.
Right, and I believe you have engaged about 14 MIT professors and to complement your existing 9 faculty that you have at ASB, at least residential professors. But by your admission, though, you describe your residential professors as young faculty, new PhDs. So really, can ASB students expect an experience that's on par with other more established schools?
Yeah. So right now, the majority of our courses are taught by senior MIT faculty, and we've hired a cadre of what we think are first-class junior faculty who will be mentored by our MIT senior faculty. So part of the agreement between Bank Negara and MIT is that MIT faculty mentor the junior faculty that we hire and bring to Malaysia. So our 9 faculty members come from 8 different countries. It's a very global group, just like our students are a very global group. All of our faculty have spent time at MIT being mentored by MIT faculty, and over time they will grow into capable star senior faculty, just like the MIT faculty have.
All right, we got a question here from a listener asking, what's the anticipated real longevity of this partnership with Bandegara? Or will this be, you know, something that's just a few years from now?
So as an initial agreement, MIT and Bandegara signed a 10-year memorandum of understanding. So we have a commitment for 10 years for this partnership. MIT Sloan School recently celebrated its 20th anniversary in a program with Tsinghua University in Beijing. That started out as a 5-year agreement, then there was another 5-year and another 5-year and another 5-year. So I think at the end of the 10 years, both Bandegara and MIT will have to look at the program and say, are we happy with this? Do we want to continue? Do we want to renew? Part of my job is to try to get to yes, right? To be successful enough as a school so that MIT says, we're delighted with this, we want to be involved. Bandegara says, we're delighted with this, we want to continue it. That's what we need to accomplish in the 10 years.
Doesn't that add to the downside risk component to this whole equation? Right? Because on one hand, you're charging elite fees, and you don't know if this program will continue 10 years from now. And you're already building a campus as well, I believe slated for 2019. So why should people sign up with you?
Well, so Bandegara is spending a significant amount of money to build a very large world-class campus for the ASB. To me, that signifies a very significant commitment by Bandegara that they're not going to give up on this. I don't think MIT is going to give up on it either. MIT is not an institute. MIT stands for Massachusetts Institute of Technology, but we're not an institute for Massachusetts. We're not an institute just for U.S. We're an institute for the world. That the technology and the innovation that comes out of MIT is devoted to making the world a better place. And as I said, Asia's the growth part of the world right now. Asia's the exciting, dynamic economy of the world, and MIT wants to play in Asia. I don't see any reason why MIT and Bandegara won't say, let's continue this. Let's keep it going.
We'll end with this. And you've now got 83 students. You plan to have about 700 students in 10 to 15 years. So you've got quite the considerable runway there. So how do you plan on getting there? And which brings us back to this question, really. Is there enough demand for MBAs and specifically for your program?
So there are 4 billion people in Asia.
Well,
I'll start with
how many
that.
Of them can afford $365,000 a year?
So it depends
on 2 years,
rather.
Right.
So as I said, you can afford the tuition if you get a good salary afterwards. You can get a good salary afterwards if you can prove your economic value in the marketplace. So that's our job. Our job is to graduate students who can deliver economic value in the marketplace. That will make the economics work. I'm not worried about the numbers. With 4 billion people in Asia, we'll find students who want to come if we're delivering the goods.
All right, and then hopefully those with that kind of risk appetite can go check you out on your website then. Thank you so much for speaking to us on the Breakfast Grill this morning. That was Professor Charles Fine, Dean of the Asia School of Business. I'm Tan Chung Han, and this is BFM 89.9.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.